This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people, some at the top of their game, others still climbing, all possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their visions. I'm not a journalist. I'm a deep thinker, a conversationalist. I won't be engaging my guests as a passive, neutral moderator. I have a perspective, an opinion on just about everything. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives. In this space, I hope to deepen, broaden, and sometimes even shift my own opinion by opening myself up to the thoughtful insights of others. I invite you to join me on this journey.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
Craig Steven Wilder is the chair of MIT's history department and has written three books, including his most recent, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. He began his career as a community organizer in the South Bronx while attending Fordham University, and earned his Ph.D. in urban history at Columbia University. Craig has taught at Williams and Dartmouth colleges, advises community and social organizations, and provides curricular and professional development workshops to public school teachers in low-income areas in New York City. He is also a senior fellow at the Bard Prison Initiative. Craig's contributions to the arts include serving as curator for national and regional exhibitions at the Brooklyn Historical Society and the Chicago History Museum, and serving as a contributor to significant documentaries, including Ken Burns' Central Park Five and Kelly Anderson's My Brooklyn. I speak with Craig about what shapes his intellectual, civic, and artistic passions, how he learned to honor and articulate sometimes tough historical matters, and why the prestige of the early American university rested on the propagation of slavery and racial inferiority. Craig, welcome to the AYG List.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities, is a remarkable contribution to American and higher education history, and I look forward to unpacking the central themes of your text on the show. But upon further research about your entire body of work, I decided that I also want my audience to learn more about you and how you combine your intellectual work with activism and creative endeavors. So tell me about your family, your childhood, and how that shaped your intellectual path. You grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, right?
I did. I grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, back when it was do or die, Bed-Stuy, and the
right.
New York Times didn't see it as the place to live in the new and upcoming neighborhood. It never appeared in the real estate section back then. And so, we grew up pretty much a single mom after I was about 3 years old who was raising us by ourselves. I have two older sisters, and who dreamed of, her dream was for us to go to college. So she talked about it all the time. She worked two jobs for about 20 years to give us that chance, and weekends, Saturday mornings, my favorite part of that story, the part I remember best, actually. She would wake us up when she got home from work. She worked a night shift overnight. And rather than going to sleep when she got home Saturday morning, she would often wake us up. And we'd all get dressed and get on the subway, and we'd go to, I don't know if you know Brooklyn very well, but Grand Army Plaza. And right down there, you had a choice when you come up out of the subway. You take two trains from Bed-Stuy to get there. You come up out of the subway, and you actually have this choice between the Brooklyn Public Library, the Brooklyn Museum, the Botanical Gardens, and Prospect Park. Mm-hmm. And so we had a vote, depending on the weather. My sisters and I would vote about where we were going. But and this was just the world that we grew up in. It was a world where my mother really had us convinced that we were heading to college. And it wasn't until I actually got to high school that I realized that there were all these obstacles, like tuition, that we hadn't thought through very well.
Right. You attended Fordham University. How was your time there, and what did it lead you to upon graduation?
It's kind of weird, even for a historian, because I think you tend to remember your life in these very romantic ways. And being a professor at MIT now and the chair of the history department here at MIT makes it even easier to romanticize that past, to create this sort of linear history where I went from high school to college to graduate school to the professoriate, and the obstacles actually now seem smoother. You know, the road seems smoother than it actually was. You know, I got to Fordham in reality in the first 2 years of college. You know, I graduated from Boys and Girls High in Bedford-Stuyvesant just before or just after the United Federation of Teachers had declared it probably the worst high school in urban America.
Wow.
You know, and got to Fordham, and I spent, you know, probably 2 years just catching up, you know, catching up on things that everybody else in my classes seemed to know and I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had my sister Gloria was in college down at Howard in D.C., and we would talk to each other by phone and sort of encourage each other along. But, you know, it was a real struggle, and I kind of started to find my way in junior year, in part because it's a Catholic university and we're born and raised Catholic. I actually started to find my way when I got off campus and started doing community service work in the South Bronx. And it was really by doing outreach through Catholic Charities, campus ministries. And this included everything from, there was an organization called POTS, which was a soup kitchen run by the Jesuits in the South Bronx, volunteering there, volunteering on, you know, voter registration drives in the South Bronx. And eventually I became a community organizer after college in the South Bronx. And that's where I found my way. That's where I found a kind of comfortable place between being a college student and being a kid from the inner city. And that helped me bridge that distance. And I remember that, you know, for me, college started to matter at that moment.
Yes. I'm having chills as I'm listening to it because I went to Kenyon College in the middle of Ohio, and I didn't have my awakening intellectually until one professor that I had my junior year who just wore me out. Actually, it was my sophomore year. He just wore me out. But I do think that there is a connection between who you are, where you come from, and having the education make meaning to you, so that it's not just you're kind of rudimentary taking these classes and the immediate application that you are able to have of saying, okay, I'm going to take these classes. I'm going to have this experience here, but connecting with that community work really sounds like it grounded you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the message that we had gotten when we were kids was, you know, if you study really hard and do well, and, you know, we were always good in school, we got good grades, we did everything we were supposed to do, but the message was actually kind of distorted.
Yeah.
If you study really hard and you do well, you can get out of here.
Yeah, it sure was.
And it was that part of the message that really kind of, I think I couldn't articulate it as a college student, but it bothered
me. Yeah.
And it was really going into the South Bronx, which wasn't my neighborhood, but it was a neighborhood just like mine, that all of a sudden I realized that there was this connection between the place I was from and the things I was learning and doing and the possibilities that opened up, that it wasn't about me escaping. It was about me coming to understand my own life in different ways and the way that I could affect that life and make it effective. Yeah.
Right. You were doing this community organizing in the South Bronx while a student. Did you continue to do it? I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I was doing, and basically what I did is I actually joined the Latino Students Association. I became the vice president of the Latino Students Association.
Okay.
Because El Grito de Lares at Fordham. And in part, actually, that was because the Latino Students Association actually did these outreach programs in the South Bronx, and I wanted to participate. And so I just showed up at one of their meetings 1 week, and and I just, you know, and they embraced me, I embraced them, and I spent the next 3.5 years as a member and officer of the Latino Students Association. But so I wasn't a community organizer yet, but I was doing actually a lot of the community work in the Bronx, tutoring across the street at Theodore Roosevelt High School, which is one of the more struggling high schools in New York, and doing a lot of that work. And then my senior year, I saw an advertisement for a community organization, South Bronx People for Change, that was sort of just pinned up on a cork board in a hallway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I remember I pulled it down and sent them my resume. And that's where community organizing started. And I spent the next year community organizing in the South Bronx. And basically the goal there was, you know, they were attracted to me because of the work I had done as an undergrad. One of the challenges for them was it was a predominantly Latino organization, and one of the things they wanted to do was to increase the African-American membership in these community groups rather than organizing Latinos in the neighborhood in one group and African-Americans in another, bring people into a community organization. And so part of my challenge while I was there was that, you know, sort of bridging that distance. And, you know, one of the best intellectual, political experiences I ever had.
Really? In what way?
Well, it taught me both the the difficulty and the benefit of that kind of work. I knew it as an undergrad.
Yeah.
You know, I knew at Fordham, I was there in the 1980s, and I knew that the conversation that was being had about students of color, about our very presence on campus and our very right to be there, was so aggressive and antagonistic that as a student, one of the other things that led me to join the Latino Students Association is that, you know, I'm Catholic. And I was actually deeply embarrassed by Catholic racism. I found it really quite disturbing as a Catholic to hear Catholics talking about, you know, the overwhelming majority of African Americans aren't Catholic. Only about, really only about 1% of African Americans in the United States are Catholic. And so really it was when I heard Catholics actually talking about Latinos who are overwhelmingly Catholic in these quite disparaging ways. And it seemed to me that we were missing the point of a Catholic university, right? The very purpose of a Catholic university was in fact to embrace and extend opportunity to Catholics who are disadvantaged. And here, simply because of the shade of people's skin, we were abandoning, running away from, and even disparaging that mission. And so that was the other thing that brought me there. It was actually, you know, brought me to the South Bronx, to working on this sort of ways in which various groups of people of color could really bridge these divisions and start to think about the ways in which they can actually cooperate to raise up these neighborhoods and empower themselves.
So you really put yourself in a very uncomfortable space in a way to do so.
It was, but it was great.
Of the
awkward places I've been in, this is probably the most fun I've ever had in the academy was as a student wandering into the Latino Students Association and just kind of explaining why I was there and then having, you know, a whole room full of people just look at me and then all of a sudden start smiling. And, you know, we're all friends to this day, and we keep in touch to this day. Yeah, and it is. And, you know, I just had lunch in New York with my old boss from the South Bronx, you know, Angel Garcia, who really, you know, was actually served not just as my boss, but as a real mentor when I was doing community organizing. Yeah.
From your time there, you took this job, and then when did you discover you wanted to pursue the PhD?
Actually, it was sort of in my senior year of college. I was in a history class with Mark Nason, who did the book Communist in Harlem during the Depression. Radical historian, and was then I believe he was chair, or he was just about to be chair of African American Studies there. I was in a class with him, and he, honestly, the story is really simple. He called me out of class, and you know, it was a class of probably 100 students. And I heard my name. You know, he said, "Who's Craig Stephen Wilder?" And I remember just sinking into my chair. I raised my hand. This is the beginning of class. He had just walked in. He said, "You know, who's Craig Wilder?" He said, "Yeah, I want to see you after class." And I spent the next 50 minutes trying to figure out what I did wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't hear a word he said that day. And afterwards, I walked up to the front, and he told me to walk back to his office with him. And it was, he had just finished reading my paper. You know, and he looked at me and said, "You know, you write like a historian. You like history. Have you ever thought about doing it?" And I just kind of looked at him like, you know, who becomes a historian? You know, what kind of life is that? You know, what kind of decision is that? You know, have you ever thought about becoming a historian? Like, what a strange, actually, question.
Right.
And that's where it started. You know, he talked me into it, and I talked myself into it over the next year or so. And I think working in the South Bronx helped a lot. Community organizing helped a lot because it forced me to realize the gap between communities of color, low-income communities, and working-class people across the United States. In fact, not just people of color, but also white people.
Oh, yeah.
And the power structures of the nation really get exposed when you're doing organizing. You realize just how big that gap is.
Yes, you do.
And how little representation we often have. And so I want, you know, in both in my frustration and in my successes led me to want to know more about that. And so it made graduate school even more appealing to me.
You studied with some of the best, Barbara Fields, Eric Foner, Kenneth Jackson, and your dissertation, Race and the History of Brooklyn, New York. Seems very personal to me now that I'm listening to you talk and after I've read everything. So what evolved in that environment at Columbia with you surrounded by those great minds, with your previous history and activism, all of that stuff percolating? Where did it lead you beyond just this book? And I want you to get into a little bit about what the book is, but where did it take you? Because it seems very, at this point, it seems very personal, but also it seems like it's starting to create this path for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of I struggled at Columbia, and not really academically. I think by the time I got to Columbia, a lot of the absences, a lot of the gaps in my education had been filled. And so I didn't lack confidence as a student by the time I got there. I think where I struggled was in the application of what I was doing to the things that really interested me personally. Right. And so, you know, I kept a connection to the South Bronx. I kept a connection to Brooklyn. I honestly, you know, got pulled between sort of, you know, maybe I should write about the Revolutionary War, something as far away from my world as I could find to protect myself emotionally. And maybe I should write about Brooklyn, right? You know, and it was a struggle. And so, and in actually what's interesting about that to me is now I look back on that book and it's a little bit personal, but in reality, part of the reason it covers the long period of Brooklyn history is exactly that. That's a compromise between those two poles, those two, you know, it's a way of sort of both reaching back into the past to escape, you know, writing about the personal. And also coming into the present where it becomes a bit more personal, at least where I feel my own life being implicated in some of the things I'm actually looking at and writing about. And so now actually I find it kind of humorous to look back at because it, in some ways it really is a compromise between two very different things that I never fully resolved as a graduate student.
Well, it's interesting. I was going to ask you this much later on in this interview, but I'm going to skip to it now because I recall my first semester at Harvard Divinity School reading two books that literally changed my life. The first one was Slave Religion by Al Rabiteau, and then the second one was In the Matter of Color by A. Leon Higginbotham. And I recall very vividly wiping tears from my face while reading this history of my people that I never knew, being angry that I was 25 and just getting the information, and I was so mad. And then all of a sudden having to be like, okay, you got to pull it together because you have to write papers, you have to take exams, you have to synthesize this information so you can pass. And it was just such
You have a job to do.
Yeah, you have a job to do, but you know what? You're black, and you know, and you're female, and this is the stuff that you never knew. And it was overwhelming, and it just occurred to me while, you know, going through the work that you have done that you had to sort all of this stuff out while researching. And a lot of this stuff is overwhelming. And how do you tell a difficult story, a difficult history of a people that you are a descendant of who were dishonored? And you know, how do you tell that story and kind of keep it all in line?
Right. I think it's a struggle. And the reality, you know, it always reminds you of those wonderful bell hooks and other sort of critiques of objectivity in the academy and the pretense to a kind of objectivity. And skin color isn't the barrier, I think, for all scholars. You know, for all scholars who do, particularly in social history, we're implicated in the things that we're writing about. We're human beings, you know, with myriad attachments and connections and values and traditions and beliefs and ties, obligations, et cetera. And those actually get implicated in the things we're writing about all the time.
Sure.
And so I think we all in some way, shape, or form, you know, struggle with this. For me, actually, what I started to do, and I think what really helped me, even in graduate school, or particularly in graduate school, is I just started to accept that fact.
Yeah.
Why, you know, why am I being apologetic for being human?
Why am
I being apologetic for being moved by the things I read? And shocked by some of them, horrified by some of them. You know, what is the reason for, you know, that's actually, that's the first step of intellectual engagement. You know, the first step of intellectual engagement is the struggle with the moral consequences of what you're looking at. And my job as a historian, therefore, as I came to see it, as it came to evolve in my own mind, wasn't to sort of control those moments or escape them or avoid them. But ultimately, the challenge was whether or not I can actually take readers on the same experience.
Can I
actually get readers to understand the moral implications of what we're looking at? And to do that, I often refer to it as, you know, we all need to make ourselves vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, I, as a black man, need to make myself vulnerable to certain realities in the past. I have to make myself vulnerable to the possibility, or in fact, the fact, that at many moments in time, American history is better understood through someone else's experiences than through mine. That my experience is not the only lens for understanding the past. It's one of many. And I have to keep those lenses. I have to keep those stories in communication. I have to keep them in dialogue. I actually have to be comfortable enough to allow other people to be central And if I can do that, you know, then that's my job, because that ultimately is what I owe the reader. I owe the reader the best explanation of the path. So, yeah, you know,
Do you think that your discipline, or just the academy in general, I mean, I'm listening to you as you speak, and I think, yeah, that's exactly right. But I don't think that we've been educated, especially in America, in that way. And it's interesting. Something just happened recently at my college alma mater, and it was clear to me that in order to be considered an educated adult in America, you could go K through 12, 4 years of a good college, mm-hmm. and not really be required to have a really nuanced cultural understanding of America or the world, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And so I see scholars like yourself and others who are kind of pushing that cart, and I don't think that it's easy at all, because we're still wed to this. And you talk about this in your book, Ebony and Ivy, where not only was there the rampant problem of slavery, but the intellectual justification for the degradation of another human body based on race, and how that's codified within the academy to justify actions and justify legal tenets. Unpacking that a little bit, I don't want to go there just yet, but how did that, as you were making that transition into your second book, In the Company of Black Men, African American Culture in New York City, how did that process continue to evolve for you?
I think you hit it right on the head. That, you know, and in fact, actually, that was the same project I was going to look at to answer your question when you first started. In the Company of Black Men, actually, for me, started as a series of accidents. But one of the things that became intriguing about the accident, I was finishing my dissertation. I was working out in Brooklyn as a kind of adjunct teacher while I finished writing. And in the library at Long Island University out in Brooklyn, there was the papers of the New York African Society, the oldest incorporated black benevolent association in the history of the United States, were being kept in just a few boxes with, you know, scribbling on the side of the boxes. And I just happened to recognize the letters, the initials. And one night, I was working in the library one night and wandering around to actually kind of wake myself up. And I saw the boxes, I saw the initials, and I started going through them, and this sort of treasure trove, right? But what did this mean for me? Actually, part of the challenge in there was not just actually writing the history of the organization, and that basically became my second book project, In the Company of Black Men, but it also reminded me that of what I didn't know, that in fact, actually, I had gone all the way through Columbia and gotten a PhD in American history, in New York history, and had actually written a dissertation that was, in fact, quite a bit about early New York, about colonial New York. And you could do that without actually taking a single course on Africa, although one out of every four people, roughly, or five people, of residents of Manhattan were of African descent. And one out of every three in Brooklyn was of African descent. And, you know, so I actually had to take basically a kind of tutorial in African history. After I finished my dissertation, I got a full-time job up at Williams College in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And friends from graduate school, like Judy Byfield, the Africanist, who was then at Dartmouth, I would just, write her email and call her and ask her questions about African history, books I should be reading, Kendah Matangi. Yeah. The Africanist, I would write, asking her, she was in my department, and I would go over to her office and bother her and just ask her, because I had to give myself this tutorial to understand, how do I actually write about African people in the colonial world? Because that wasn't the training. And so you're absolutely right. In fact, actually, a lot of this we've had to invent on the fly.
Yeah.
We've had to create for ourselves. But my hope is that conversation, that training, that tradition is actually changing very rapidly.
Yeah. And much thanks to you. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
So in addition to, before I get into Ebony and Ivy, you are interesting to me because you still engage in the work of curricular and professional development workshops in public schools and lower income areas in New York and advising community and social organizations. I discovered the Bard Prison Initiative. I was researching you and was stunned by that and want very desperately for my own college alma mater to become involved in something that great. Tell me how all of this, like you pull all of these things together, you're a scholar and clearly dedicated to impeccable scholarship. And then you also have this longing and this yearning to make sure that the work that you're doing kind of trickles down and is relevant to people and communities that you're deeply connected to. Tell me how that works for you and how you find the time to do it.
Well, the time to do it part is hard.
Right.
But the, you know, you kind of beg, borrow, and steal for the time to do it. And, you know, I think one of the rewards, one of the benefits of our work should be that it buys us a little bit of freedom to do things that matter personally to us.
Right.
And so if, you know, if publishing books matters, then for me, what I want in it is I want that to then give me the freedom to do things that matter socially. And if, you know, teaching courses, all the other things that we do as academics, I want that to buy me a little bit of time to do things that I think matter socially. Now, on the other hand, let me say, you know, this is not about, you know, Sister Francesca Thompson, who taught us, an African-American woman and nun, who was one of my professors when I was at Fordham, used to often remind us that, you know, and chastise us. You know, giving is in fact a selfish act, as she described her career.
Yeah.
You know, and let me say that's perfectly true for me. In fact, mm-hmm. remaining tied when I was in graduate school, I used to go back to the South Bronx, to central Brooklyn, and work with community organizations. And part of the reason that I did that wasn't only that I was invested in these organizations and I had a relationship to them, it's also that they helped keep me sane while I was in graduate school.
Yeah.
You know, going back to Brooklyn and, you know, just being in my old neighborhood helped keep me sane while I was in graduate school. It helped me make sense of these experiences. And I tried to remind myself over and over again, which is difficult to do if you don't leave these spaces, that I didn't want to spend my whole career in an ivory tower. I didn't want to spend my whole career in my office writing for a small group of colleagues in other offices like mine scattered around the country. But I wanted to actually, you know, get out and pay for the right to have acquired this degree. You know, in my mind, my sisters and I made it out of poverty and into the middle class. You know, we made it out of, you know, got the full credentials if one needs them. You know, inner city, big, large black neighborhood, heavily impoverished by the time we were there, lot, you know, violent, overcrowded, failing schools. You know, we were on food stamps. We had hungry days and hungry nights and all those things. And we made it from there to where we are today, not because we were extraordinarily driven and focused 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 14-year-olds. I never was. You know, I was a bright kid who got some opportunities and whose mother and sisters threatened my life to keep me in line.
Right.
You know, they threatened to kill me on a daily basis
right.
to keep me in line and mm-hmm. shepherded over me very, very carefully. And, you know, and it would be a sin for me to forget that fact.
Absolutely.
But also because a whole neighborhood full of people actually sacrificed and worked to get a few kids opportunities mm-hmm. outside the neighborhood. And so for me, going back to the neighborhood and just trying, or the neighborhoods, and trying to make sure that a bright 12-year-old living in that same neighborhood today has at least the same chance of success as I had is a moral obligation. And, you know, I don't know that I could live with myself without that. And honestly, I think it's harder today to escape from poverty in that neighborhood than it was when I was a kid. You know, when I was a kid, the neighborhood actually had programs.
Yeah, it's true.
It had publicly funded programs and opportunities, and there was a much more aggressive affirmative action structure and opportunity structure for kids than there is today. You know, and so all of that has fallen apart. And so for me, actually, a lot of this work has just been about my own sanity as a human
mm-hmm.
being
mm-hmm.
and my own sense of humanity within the academy. And I think the thing that, you know, the thing that motivates me as a scholar is precisely found and rediscovered when I leave these spaces and go out into the neighborhoods, into the prisons, and into, you know, because that's where the cutting edge social problems, crises, and opportunities are.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you see it as an opportunity. Your contribution to the arts is also significant as a curator for national and regional art exhibitions, including the Brooklyn Historical Society, Chicago History Museum, and serving as one of the original historians of the Museum of Sex in New York City. You also served as a contributor to significant documentaries, including Kim Burns' Central Park Five, and Kelly Anderson's My Brooklyn, and the History Channel's FDR Presidency Revealed. What muscles do these artistic endeavors allow you to flex that you can't in your traditional academic environment?
Oh, wow. again, this is something where, you know, I could take a lot of credit, but I don't deserve a lot of it. When I was in graduate school, in fact, actually fairly early in my graduate school career, one of the unfortunate events in New York City, I was up at Columbia, and the Crown Heights riots erupted in August 1991 in Brooklyn. And, you know, the New York Times Foundation, the Brooklyn Historical Society, Weeksville, which is the African-American heritage site inside central Brooklyn and marks the site, including some of the original buildings, of the first free black community, permanent to residential free black community in New York. And the Brooklyn Children's Museum and some other institutions came together to respond to the riots. And they needed advisory help. And what happened is, I think, as far as I can remember, they ended up calling Columbia looking for someone who worked on Brooklyn and African-Americans in Brooklyn.
And there you were.
And, and they said, well, I think we have a graduate student who just started his dissertation or is thinking about the dissertation on this. So there I was. The next day I was in the Brooklyn Historical Society, which I had passed dozens of times as a kid but had never actually gone into the building. And I was sitting there for a meeting talking. And so my relationship to public history, museums, and documentaries and that sort of thing began there. It began just with sitting there thinking to myself, this is my neighborhood. I know this neighborhood. I spent my entire childhood wandering from Crown Heights to Bed-Stuy and Bed-Stuy to Crown Heights. You know, you look out on Crown Heights from Boys and Girls High, from the south side of Boys and Girls High, and you look out at Bed-Stuy from the north side. So I know this neighborhood. I know the people. And so I decided that it was worth doing and trying to do. And so we spent the next few years actually working with the communities, working on exhibits about the various ethnic and social and religious groups and the racial, social, and religious groups within the communities, pulling community people into the process and hopefully actually doing something fairly novel, which was, you know, we wanted to have community engagement in virtually all aspects of the process of designing, creating, and installing the exhibits. And, you know, and so it began there. And after that, I started working with other museums in Chicago, in D.C., Philadelphia, in New York State. But one of the things that I learned from the Crown Heights Project was, you know, it reminded me of the fact that there are social obligations to being a scholar. You know, I don't for a moment fail to recognize that I get to live an extraordinarily privileged life. And one of the obligations, the cost or the price of that, and the price of it actually makes it sound negative. I mean this in a positive way. The price of it is I have an obligation to actually give back to people, to communities of people, to the society. And you reach people through those kinds of projects. And so whenever there are moments where I think I can be of help to a project that I actually politically and morally support, I feel an obligation to try to do it.
You know, it's interesting. I wrote a piece on my blog that is no longer there, unfortunately, because of a technical glitch, about my reaction to the Central Park 5 documentary. And it was after, and I love Ken Burns to state a fact and his body of work, but there was a piece that was written by Patricia Williams about the documentary. And in that piece, she talked about how she was around and how she was really engaged in the process of telling a different sort of narrative about what was happening during that period of time. And what struck me about it was Patricia Williams is a Wellesley, Harvard-educated woman who was teaching at Columbia, a part of institutions that everybody else in the world valued. But her voice in that moment wasn't valued. And it took this documentary to actually give credence to what she was saying. And this documentary happened to be done by a very well-respected and well-regarded and gifted and talented white man. And so I guess my question to you, or the reflection that I want you to consider, is when you are sitting in those rooms and you realize that you are at a table that will define history, really, for so many people and for generations to come, one, how is that experience felt by you? But two, do you sense that there's kind of a push and pull about whose narrative gets to be privileged in those environments? Have you experienced that? Because you seem to, in the last part of it, you were like, this was really good and this was novel that we got other people to have, you know, a community component to this where those voices were held. But I think a lot of the colleagues that I know and some of the projects that I've been a part of the frustration was they want you at the table, but they want you to co-sign a narrative that you don't necessarily want to co-sign.
Right, and they draw a line between the professionals and the people, right? And what we were trying to do was gray that line in the Crown Heights Project. I'm always very careful about what projects I'm willing to do, and to a point where I think I probably annoy a lot of people inviting me to do the projects. And I understand that they're very well-intentioned, they're good folks. Mm-hmm. The producers and creators of My Brooklyn, the documentary on gentrification, I went to a screening of the film with them, and one of the audience members asked the director if she felt awkward talking about gentrification given that she's a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she answered it, and then she turned to me and said, well, did you feel awkward because I'm white? And I said, no, mm-hmm. I felt awkward because I'm black. And it's very easy to take me, to take my image, my voice, my background, and allow me to substitute for working class black people today.
Yeah.
To allow me to take their place and speak for them. And so my concern, the reason I was hesitant at first, and, we got to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know more about the project, and I became much more invested in it and actually, spent a lot of time trying to help with it. And I love the project today. I love My Brooklyn. I think it's a great documentary. It raises some really important issues and does them and raises them really well. But it took me time to get there. And part of that was gaining a kind of confidence in the shorthand with the direction of the project and how I was going to be used. Because I think part of my job is not to speak for black folk or brown folk or poor folks. It's actually to create an opportunity for them to be heard. With the Sarah Burns and Ken Burns project documentary, The Central Park Five, I had known the Burns earlier through other projects. And one of the things that I really appreciated was, in fact, recognizing the same impulse on a much bigger scale, that I hope I see in myself, which is Ken Burns' willingness to use his public platform to bring this issue, this critical issue, the plight of these young men, to the public and to create a stage for allowing them to be heard, to allowing them to tell their stories, in which, it was hard to be dismissive of them precisely because of the production team behind the project. And so I think, it was exciting to see, and, I was honored to be involved, but it was also really quite exciting to see his willingness to put his own reputation on the line to make sure that this story got heard. And I think that, it's unusual, and I think it should be celebrated. It's unfortunately increasingly rare in our society because everyone's way too cautious, way too careful, and far too concerned about, individual success over our social responsibilities.
You've taught at Williams and Dartmouth colleges. What did teaching in those environments teach you?
Wow. I think one of the things I learned, and actually part of the reason I took the job at Williams up in Massachusetts, Western Mass, is that I realized coming out of graduate school that I probably needed to leave New York to become a better New York historian.
Mm-hmm.
Being in New York, I think I was a well-trained historian. But I think I also think I lacked the perspective on New York City that I needed. And so leaving New York, and although Western Mass isn't that far away, it's in some ways a world away. And so it really did help me to change the way I think about the history of the city. It helped me think about the way that I position African-American history within the broader narratives of American history. And so I think it just gave me a kind of perspective. And then going up to Dartmouth was similar. But I think the challenge at Dartmouth was a little bit different. I think the challenge at Dartmouth was that Dartmouth expanded my horizons as a teacher. And I had been a successful teacher at Williams, but going to Dartmouth forced me to give up classes, adopt new classes, change the format of my classes. And so it just forced me to sort of become more flexible as a teacher. And that was fantastic for me.
Yeah.
It was also, in some ways, the beginning of a new tutorial in Native American history, because Dartmouth has an extraordinary Native American studies program, certainly the best in the Ivy League and one of the best, certainly the best undergraduate program, probably the best undergraduate program in the nation.
Tell me about your move to MIT and the opportunity it presented.
Again, part of it was the looking for this sort of professional challenge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I decided that there probably wouldn't be a greater professional challenge than teaching history at a school where most of the students major in engineering and the sciences.
Right. Right.
And it's been a lot of fun. You know, I like the engineering ethos of sort of go out and fix it. In part, being at MIT has made it easier for me to do things like the Bard Prison Initiative, because we can make arguments to MIT, to administration, that there are social projects and services that we can provide. And they tend to be quite supportive of that. You know, they tend to respond with, okay, go out and fix it. You know, go out and
love
do
it.
What's right.
That's right.
Yeah, and so I think that, you know, I think more institutions need to have that mentality. Mm-hmm. And so I really enjoyed that part of being at MIT. The Institute has been extraordinarily supportive of the projects that I have outside the academy and in unusual, you know, alternative spaces within the academy.
When did you start your research on ebony and ivy, and what precipitated it?
It was 2002. I had, you know, taken the job at Dartmouth, and I left Williams for Dartmouth. And I honestly started with something very simple. I was going to write an article, an essay, on how black abolitionists in New York, who I had written about in the second book in particular, in the Company of Black Men, how black abolitionists actually got their educations and entered the professions. How do you become a minister, a doctor, a teacher in a city in the decades before the Civil War when you couldn't attend college?
That's right.
And a lot of those stories are actually New England stories. A lot of, you know, in Philadelphia and New York, a lot of these young men and women came up to these short-lived schools in New England or studied privately with ministers and et cetera. And so I traveled around. I got in the car and just sort of traveled around to these little towns where these schools had lived or where, you know, a particularly generous minister had been, where abolitionists had been, and I started collecting the stories and putting it together. And I actually became more interested, in part because I was at Dartmouth with that fantastic Native American Studies program,
yeah.
I became more interested in the distinction between Native Americans and African Americans at this moment.
Yeah.
You know, by the 1830s, Native Americans had been on campus for almost 200 years as students.
Yeah.
And so the barrier was not just race. Something else was happening.
Yeah.
And I started to realize that the something else was that the institutions that I had always seen, these colleges, that I had always seen as these sort of passive and benevolent institutions that sat in the backdrop of history, were actually shaping history. They were deciding who was educable, and they were engaged in political projects of their own that often required the exclusion of certain populations of people, and even the degradation of certain populations of
people.
That's right. And the strategic inclusion of others. And so, you know, what explains the difference between Native Americans and African Americans is not, in fact, that Native Americans are privileged in this system. It's that education gets strategically deployed to further the cause of both colonialism and conquest.
Yeah. You know, it's revolutionary to me as someone who studied the history of higher education at Columbia at Teachers College in the early 90s, right? So I was in a higher ed program, and we had a really intense higher ed history class, and this was never touched. I mean, it's so interesting to me. I mean, it's just funny because as I was reading the book, I'm like, how in the world did we just not cover this? Why are we privileging certain things and we're not privileging others? So there are a few places I want you to go, because I really want my listeners to read your book, and I don't want to tell them too much, because there's just it's so rich, even with the 200 years of educating Native Americans. And I have to say, as a side note, I'm really grateful for the detail that you paid to the Native American experience during that time period, because I really do think it balances your treatment of what was happening with Africans in the New World at that point in time. But you explain in great detail the extent to which early colleges and universities were intimately connected to the slave trade. Not only were the enslaved owned by most of the leaders of these storied institutions, the enslaved actually built them, they ensured their proper day-to-day operations, and they were actually even brought to campus by students, not just in the Deep South, as we always presume, but in the Deep North. Why is this book so new, so fresh, such a revelation with this factual history? Why has this story never been told?
Well, I think there are a couple of things happening. One is the centrality of Native American history to the overall project is one that I decided several years into the project. You know, it kept changing. It kept growing and changing. It took me 11 years to write this book.
Yeah.
You know, because you have to visit all these campuses, these town archives and county historical societies and all this. But in part, actually, it also took that long because I decided quite a few years ago, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, that Native American history had to be more central to the story. And this is where, when we were talking earlier about making ourselves vulnerable,
yes.
We have to accept these moments where to understand the African American experience, one has to look away from the experiences of African Americans. Or in other words, you have to see what's happening to Native Americans to understand slavery in these moments, right? And particularly in the history of higher education. And so that part of the project to me was part of what I'm most proud of in the book. I think I hope that one of its long contributions will be that we begin to see that dynamic. And I also didn't want to treat Native American history and African American history as part of a single story of a common oppression, because in fact that's not how colonialism operates either. You know, and so one could create a kind of false mutual sympathy in which these are just oppressed people. And they're oppressed in the same way. And in fact, colonialism just doesn't work that way. They're often, voluntarily or not, engaged in and accelerating the destruction of the other group. You know, I often describe this in class with, if you think about England's history in Scotland and Ireland, Frederick Douglass would describe it quite beautifully. The oppressed on one side of the Atlantic Ocean can easily be transformed into the oppressors on the other. And, you know, so you have these real tensions built into this moment in this history. And so, you know, really for me, the project was always one where my goal was to try and get readers to understand the complexity of this past and then to really open our eyes about, as you put it, you know, why this has been hidden from us. You know, why don't we know this? And I think the why not is that we've never been especially honest about the history of slavery. You know, we released the history of slavery in leaks and in, you know, small pieces. It takes us years and decades to accept small facts about the history of slavery. We've been in denial for a long time. And so the argument, increasingly understood and by scholars, that slavery is central to the Atlantic world, that the African slave trade is central to the colonial world as we know it, and therefore to the rise of the United States, is an argument that sounds new and provocative, although the evidence for it has always been around. You know, one of the things I found interesting in doing the research for the book is that if you think about Yale, for instance, I've been picking on Harvard a lot recently, so I'll leave them alone for today. That's right. I'll leave it alone, I promise. But if you think about Yale, you know, in the histories of Yale, the histories written by the faculty and the university in the 19th century and 20th century, the story of slavery, the evidence for Yale's relationship to slavery and the slave trade, the same evidence I found, those scholars found, they came across the same exact body of material that I came across. There are a few new things. Because I came across what they came across, I then looked for further connections. To fully explain what was happening. But in fact, actually, the central pieces of material, they actually had too. And what did they do with it? You know, very often, either it was just erased, it was ignored in these institutional histories, or it was included in a way that erased the moral consequences of enslavement and the slave trade. I often use the example of enslaved Africans who lived on campus, who were owned by college presidents, who were owned by faculty, who were owned by students, from time to time actually make it into these institutional histories, but they make it in a way where they become caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're described as drunk and violent, foolish, abusive to the students, a threat to the overall morality of the campus, a constant source of disorder, and they're lampooned in such ways as, by the end, the moral consequences of their presence on campus as slaves is no longer a question for the reader. It's no longer even relevant to the reader. And that's the problem. So, for example, when I was looking at Yale, we know that George Berkeley, the British minister, who comes in the 1720s, and he has his own plan. He comes to Rhode Island. He goes to Rhode Island from England, Ireland and England. And he has his own plan to build a college on Bermuda. And the plan is he's going to build a college on Bermuda, and he's going to take Native American children from friendly nations and kidnap Indian children from enemy nations and educate them there and then send them back into their own nations as ambassadors of a true Christianity to mm-hmm. accelerate the process of their cultural transformations and the sort of cultural wars of the colonial era. He gets promised $20,000 from Parliament. He arrives in Rhode Island waiting for that money to come. Eventually, the project falls through. But what Berkeley does while he's in Rhode Island is he buys a farm. He names it Whitehall after Parliament, after the Parliament building, and he starts buying slaves. Mm. When the project falls apart, he donates the farm to Yale. He donates an extraordinary art collection and book collections to Yale and to Harvard. And Yale then leases out Whitehall for the next several decades as a farm to slave-holding farmers. It continues to operate as a small slave plantation inside Rhode Island. And this is how Yale funds its first graduate programs and graduate student scholarships, including the ones that people like, you know, Thomas Clapp, who ends up the president of Yale, gets, and Eliezer Wheelock, the founder of Dartmouth, is mm-hmm. on. This actually becomes particularly important to the cash-starved Yale College, which for at least for its first century is almost always on the verge of collapse. And so, you know, that part of the history we actually knew.
Right.
But it was included in ways that it was largely obscured, and the moral and intellectual consequences of it were largely erased.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. As I was reading through the book, one of the things that kind of popped up at me was you talked a lot about the imperative for kind of the fiscal life of the campus, that this and how fundraising was a part of this notion that we're civilizing Native Americans with regard to the propagation of a certain spiritual lens. Mm-hmm. But there's a complicated mixture here of religion and race science and racially right. motivated intellectual bigotry. And it's all sort of packed into one. Can you unpack that a little bit? Because I think part of what people don't understand is beyond dehumanizing of other human beings and the subjugation of other human beings to varying degrees, that in addition to that, we start to codify in an intellectual and educational system a way of thinking about bodies and human beings based on right. race that honestly is something we're still choked by today.
In fact, actually, you know, it's for that reason that the book is basically divided. It's divided into two parts. The first mm-hmm. part is slavery and the rise of the American college. And the second part is race and the rise of the American college, because I actually wanted readers to understand that, you know, the fate of a college was very much tied to its ability to, a colonial college, mm-hmm. was very much tied to its ability to tap into the slave economies of the Atlantic world, you know, mm. the slave traders of the Northeast, of New England and the Mid-Atlantic, and the large planters of the West Indies and the American South. Yeah, and so if you see the colleges that survive in the colonial era, you know, Harvard, William and Mary, Yale, Princeton, Penn, Columbia, Brown, Rutgers, Dartmouth, you know, they survive by tapping into that slave economy. Mm-hmm. They're hunting mm-hmm. for students, for donations, and for money in the West Indies, in the South, and they're largely founded by, you know, they're often founded by slave traders and people who have their, you know, economic hands in some aspect of the slave economy. But the second part of the book is really about race and the rise of the American Academy, because, in fact, the social prestige of the American college rests upon the ability of colleges to actually animate and create an intellectual tradition that actually matters in the public sphere. It rests upon their ability to enter the public sphere convincingly, and race gives them that language. Race gives them a language for entering into the most central and sensitive political questions of the late 18th and 19th century, the question of slavery and the slave trade, the morality of it, the economic justice of it, the economic integrity of it. Race gives them a language for entering into these sensitive, provocative political questions, and ultimately, actually, I argue in the book, coming to triumph over the church in these sort of political questions, or science yeah. comes to trump religion ultimately. And so race science in particular gives entry to the public sphere, and it allows the American college to actually cultivate a new prestige for the academy. And a way of thinking about this is that in the 18th century, you know, at the beginning of the American Revolution, a lot of college presidents had actually been heavily involved in the Revolutionary era in revolutionary politics, including John Winthrop at Princeton, and then in the College of New Jersey, the famous president of the College of New Jersey at Princeton, a Scotsman who comes to the Americas just before the Revolution breaks out and leads Princeton through the Revolutionary period. But Winthrop, even according to his biographers, is a leading figure in the American Revolution, not because he's the president of Princeton, but because he's probably the most recognizable voice of the Presbyterians in North America. He's a revolutionary leader because he's a religious leader. It's his Presbyterianism that's there. By the 1830s, college presidents are actually entering into the public sphere on questions like slavery, colonization, the removal of free black people from the entire continent, and even Indian removal, not because they're ministers, but because they're college presidents. It's actually the university and the college title that they're using. And part of what that rests upon is their claims to a new secular authority based in science and with the claims of scientific accuracy that's largely rooted in race.
Well, you know, you do talk about this racial cleansing during that time period, and in some very important ways, it ties all of the things in your book together. And based on what you just said to me, there was this kind of intellectual capital that kind of separating the newfound intellectual efficacy of this kind of racially motivated way of thinking about people that was codified gives them. And it separates them from the moral imperative of having to think about treating another human being in this way. How does the racial cleansing part of it tie in? Because I think part of the racial cleansing campaign had to assert something really major that fell on all of these people in a way that made it even considerable as a viable option.
Yeah. I mean, one way to think about it is actually during the American Revolution, Ezra Stiles, the Reverend Ezra Stiles, who's the president of Yale, after he becomes president of Yale, Stiles actually is a slave owner. He purchases a boy as a younger minister when he's a younger minister in Rhode Island and then sets that man free the day before he becomes the president of Yale, before he leaves to enter the president's house in New Haven. Stiles, once he's in New Haven, actually helps to establish the Connecticut Abolition Society. And a lot of the Yale faculty join that society in the 1780s. 40 years later, the president of Yale, the Reverend Jeremiah Day, is one of the leaders, the vice president of the American Colonization Society, which is founded a couple of decades earlier with the goal of removing free black people from the United States. Right. And how do we explain, and Day is actually an opponent of abolition. He's a colonizationist. And, you know, how do we explain that 40-year transformation? Part of the explanation I offer in the book is actually what happens to the academy as science gets institutionalized, I was recently talking about this in New York, and I said, you know, Methodism actually poses a similar challenge in the 18th century because it's anti-slavery, it's radical evangelicalism, and it believes in the equality of all human beings, and Methodist ministers are being chased out of the South, they're being chased and threatened in the West Indies. And how do you tame these radical ministers? Well, the planters of Virginia, as one historian once noted, finally realized that you didn't have to chase them out. What you had to start doing is buying them churches. As Methodist ministers went from being itinerant pastors to church-based pastors with pews that were for sale and congregations who tithed, that by itself was a de-radicalizing influence on Methodism, right? And something similar happens in the academy. Science is actually, to some extent, quite revolutionary in the 18th century. As you know, many scholars have pointed out, a lot of the early race scientists are actually anti-slavery. But when we begin establishing medical schools on colonial campuses, and when trustees begin funding professorships in the sciences, in chemistry and geology and the natural and human sciences, one of the consequences of that is that the sciences get brought under the dominion of the same slave traders and slave owners who funded American colleges to begin with. And that fact then actually, you know, politicizes science in overt and subtle ways. And so one of the things that you end up with 40 years after Ezra Stiles is establishing the, you know, the Connecticut Abolition Society from Yale, the president of Yale, Jeremiah Day, is leading a movement to cleanse North America of the free black population, and a movement that increasingly, certainly by the 1830s, you know, if colonization starts out with a kind of humanitarian underbelly to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's lost by the 1830s. By the 1830s, colonization is arguing basically the inferiority of black people and the impossibility of their incorporation into the citizenry of the United States. And it's running concurrent with other removal campaigns, the campaign to remove Native Americans from the Southeast, the Indian removal campaign, and the campaign to convert or remove the Jewish population, which runs through organizations like the American Society for Amelioration of the Condition of the Jews, which is focused on either converting Jews to Christianity or paying for their removal from the United States. Or in other words, these concurrent movements that are focused on creating the United States as an all-white, all-Christian nation and are rooted in a tight, rigid, immutable racial definition of the future of the United States and progress.
In very simplistic terms, what do you hope that readers gain from this book?
I hope that they gain a new appreciation for the ways in which slavery, the slave trade, shaped the early colonial world and ultimately the rise of the United States. And I think one of the reasons for looking at colleges is that colleges actually provide a provocative, new, interesting way of thinking about that.
Yeah.
And so while the book is a book about colleges, the central point of the book is actually rethinking the way we understand that world. That, you know, it's not just colleges. It's
right.
churches. It's hospitals. It's libraries. The first public libraries, some of the first hospitals are all actually funded by the same people. And they rise at the same exact moment. And that moment is the height of the African slave trade in the Atlantic world.
What lights you up as a person?
Wow. I think, the great lesson that I take from history is that human beings are capable of radical transformation and societies are capable of radical transformation. So no matter how bleak we might look at any given moment, we actually have the capacity within us to actually transform for the better. And I think that's actually, in even the most dismal history, there's some of that to be found. And even in the most dismal moment, there's some of that that peeks out.
Yeah, yeah. If you were not a scholar, activist, curator, what would you be?
I have no idea. I think I'd probably, if it was up to my mother, I'd be a very unhappy attorney. Because that was her goal.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, I mean, she would want me to be happy. She wanted me to be an attorney, and I would contribute. I would be a very unhappy attorney.
Oh, I bet you'd be a good one, though. All right, so I want our audience to know that you have kindly agreed to give away a copy of your book, Ebony and Ivy, Race,
Absolutely.
Slavery, and the Troubled History of American Universities. I hope that everybody listening is encouraged to go purchase the book. If you already have it, purchase another one for a friend, share it, donate it to a library of a school that you attended, or give it to a young person. I am a baseball fan, and in my mind, you are a five-tool intellectual player. For your scholarship, community service, service to the arts, commitment to teaching everyday people and future generations. I am sure that I speak for many when I say that I am grateful for all of your gifts. Thank you so much, Craig Stephen Wilder, MIT Professor of History and Chair of the History Department, for joining me on the AYG list today.
Thank you for having me.
Craig Stephen Wilder was kind enough to offer his book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities, to one of my listeners. Please visit the AYG list on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to find the trivia question you must answer to win. Good luck.
You've been listening to the AYG list with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG list posts every Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.